it was amazing and all. She's got makeup. It's a miracle. But Leo had problems to deal with. He ducked out of the amphitheater and ran into the darkness, wondering what he'd gotten himself into. He'd stood up in front of a bunch of stronger, braver demigods and volunteered. Volunteered for a mission that would probably get him killed. He hadn't mentioned seeing Tia Kaida, his old babysitter, but as soon as he'd heard about Jason's vision, the lady in the black dress and shawl, Leo knew it was the same woman. Tia Kaida was Hera. His evil babysitter was the queen of the gods. Stuff like that could really deep fry your brain. He trudged toward the woods and tried not to think about his childhood, all the messed up things that had led to his mother's death, but he couldn't help it. The first time Tia Kaida tried to kill him, he must have been about 2. Tia Kaida was looking after him while his mother was at the machine shop. She wasn't really his aunt, of course, just one of the old women in the community, a generic Tia who helped watch the kids. She smelled like a honey-baked ham and always wore a widow's dress with a black shawl.
"Let's set you down for a nap," she said. "Let's see if you are my brave little hero, eh?"
Leo was sleepy. She nestled him into his blankets and a warm mound of red and yellow pillows? The bed was like a cubbyhole in the wall, made of blackened bricks, with a metal slot over his head and a square hole far above, where he could see the stars. He remembered resting comfortably, grabbing at sparks like fireflies. He dozed and dreamed of a boat made of fire, sailing through the cinders. He imagined himself on board, navigating the sky. Somewhere nearby, Tia Kaida sat in her rocking chair. Creak, 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 and sang a lullaby. Even at 2, Leo knew the difference between English and Spanish, and he remembered being puzzled because Tia Kaida was singing in a language that was neither. Everything was fine until his mother came home. She screamed and raced over to snatch him up, yelling at Tia Kaida, "How could you?" But the old lady had disappeared. Leo remembered looking over his mother's shoulder at the flames curling around his blankets. Only years later had he realized he'd been sleeping in a blazing fireplace. The weirdest thing? Tia Kaida hadn't been arrested or even banished from their house. She appeared again several times over the next few years. Once when Leo was 3, she let him play with knives.
"You must learn your blades early," she insisted, "if you are to be my hero someday."
Leo managed not to kill himself, but he got the feeling Tia Kaida wouldn't have cared one way or the other. When Leo was 4, Tia found a rattlesnake for him in a nearby cow pasture. She gave him a stick and encouraged him to poke the animal.
"Where is your bravery, little hero? Show me the fates were right to choose you."
Leo stared down at those amber eyes, hearing the dry shh, shh, shh of the snake's rattle. He couldn't bring himself to poke the snake. It didn't seem fair. Apparently, the snake felt the same way about biting a little kid. Leo could have sworn it looked at Tia Kaida like, "Are you nuts, lady?" Then it disappeared into the tall grass. The last time she babysat him, Leo was 5. She brought him a pack of crayons and a pad of paper. They sat together at the picnic table in back of the apartment complex, under an old pecan tree. While Tia Kaida sang her strange songs, Leo drew a picture of the boat he'd seen in the flames, with colorful sails and rows of oars, a curved stern, and an awesome masthead. When he was almost done, about to sign his name the way he'd learned in kindergarten, a wind snatched the picture away. It flew into the sky and disappeared. Leo wanted to cry. He'd spent so much time on that picture, but Tia Kaida just clucked with disappointment.
"It isn't time yet, little hero. Someday you'll have your quest. You'll find your destiny, and your hard journey will finally make sense. But first, you must face many sorrows. I regret that, but heroes cannot be shaped any other way. Now, make me a fire, eh? Warm these old bones.
A few minutes later, Leo's mom came out and shrieked with horror. Tia Kaida was gone, but Leo sat in the middle of a smoking fire. The pad of paper was reduced to ashes. Crayons had melted into a bubbling puddle of multicolored goo, and Leo's hands were ablaze, slowly burning through the picnic table. For years afterward, people in the apartment complex would wonder how someone had seared the impressions of a 5-year-old's hands an inch deep into solid wood. Now Leo was sure that Tia Kaida, his psychotic babysitter, had been Hira all along. That made her, what, his godly grandmother? His family was even more messed up than he realized. He wondered if his mother had known the truth. Leo remembered, after that last visit, his mom took him inside and had a long talk with him, but he only understood some of it.
"She can't come back again."
His mom had a beautiful face with kind eyes and curly dark hair, but she looked older than she was because of hard work. The lines around her eyes were deeply etched. Her hands were calloused. She was the first person from their family to graduate from college. She had a degree in mechanical engineering and could design anything, fix anything, build anything. No one would hire her. No company would take her seriously, so she ended up in the machine shop, trying to make enough money to support the two of them. She always smelled of machine oil, and when she talked with Leo, she switched from Spanish to English constantly, using them like complementary tools. It took Leo years to realize that not everyone spoke that way. She'd even taught him Morse code as a kind of game, so they could tap messages to each other when they were in different rooms. "I love you. You okay?" Simple things like that.
"I don't care what Kaida says," his mom told him. "I don't care about destiny and the fates. You're too young for that. You're still my baby."
She took his hands, looking for burn marks, but of course there weren't any.
"Leo, listen to me. Fire is a tool like anything else, but it's more dangerous than most. You don't know your limits. Please promise me, no more fire until you meet your father. Someday, mijo, you will meet him. He'll explain everything."
Leo had heard that since he could remember. Someday he would meet his dad. His mom wouldn't answer any questions about him. Leo had never met him, never even seen pictures, but she talked like he'd just gone to the store for some milk and he'd be back any minute. Leo tried to believe her. Someday everything would make sense. For the next couple of years, they were happy. Leo almost forgot about Tia Kaida. He still dreamed of the flying boat, but the other strange events seemed like a dream too. It all came apart when he was 8. By then, he was spending every free hour at the shop with his mom. He knew how to use the machines. He could measure and do math better than most adults. He'd learned to think three-dimensionally, solving mechanical problems in his head the way his mom did. One night they stayed late because his mom was finishing a drill bit design she hoped to patent. If she could sell the prototype, it might change their lives. She'd finally get a break. As she worked, Leo passed her supplies and told her corny jokes, trying to keep her spirits up. He loved it when he could make her laugh. She'd smile and say, "Your father would be proud of you, mijo. You'll meet him soon, I'm sure." Mom's workspace was at the very back of the shop. It was kind of creepy at night, because they were the only ones there. Every sound echoed through the dark warehouse, but Leo didn't mind as long as he was with his mom. If he did wander the shop, they could always keep in touch with Morse code taps. Whenever they were ready to leave, they had to walk through the entire shop, through the break room, and out to the parking lot, locking the doors behind them. That night after finishing up, they'd just gotten to the break room when his mom realized she didn't have her keys. "That's funny." She frowned. "I know I had them. Wait here, mijo. I'll only be a minute." She gave him one more smile, the last one he'd ever get, and she went back into the warehouse. She'd only been gone a few heartbeats when the interior door slammed shut. Then the exterior door locked itself.
"Mom?"
Leo's heart pounded. Something heavy crashed inside the warehouse. He ran to the door, but no matter how hard he pulled or kicked, it wouldn't open.
"Mom!"
Frantically, he tapped a message on the wall. "You okay?"
"She can't hear you," a voice said.
Leo turned and found himself facing a strange woman. At first he thought it was Tia Kaita. She was wrapped in black robes, with a veil covering her face.
"Tia?"
he said. The woman chuckled, a slow, gentle sound, as if she were half asleep.
"I am not your guardian. Merely a family resemblance."
What do you want? Where's my mom?"
"Ah, loyal to your mother. How nice. But you see, I have children too. And I understand you will fight them someday. When they try to wake me, you will prevent them. I cannot allow that."
"I don't know you. I don't want to fight anybody."
She muttered like a sleepwalker in a trance.
"A wise choice."
With a chill, Leo realized the woman was, in fact, asleep. Behind the veil, her eyes were closed. But even stranger, her clothes were not made of cloth. They were made of earth. Dry, black dirt churning and shifting around her. Her pale, sleeping face was barely visible behind a curtain of dust, and he had the horrible sense that she'd just risen from the grave. If the woman was asleep, Leo wanted her to stay that way. He knew that fully awake, she would be even more terrible.
"I cannot destroy you yet," the woman murmured. "The fates will not allow it. But they do not protect your mother, and they cannot stop me from breaking your spirit. Remember this night, little hero, when they ask you to oppose me."
"Leave my mother alone!"
Fear rose in his throat as the woman shuffled forward. She moved more like an avalanche than a person, a dark wall of earth shifting toward him.
"How will you stop me?"
she whispered. She walked straight through a table, the particles of her body reassembling on the other side. She loomed over Leo, and he knew she would pass right through him, too. He was the only thing between her and his mother. His hands caught fire. A sleepy smile spread across the woman's face, as if she'd already won. Leo screamed with desperation. His vision turned red. Flames washed over the earthen woman, the walls, the locked doors, and Leo lost consciousness. When he woke, he was in an ambulance. The paramedic tried to be kind. She told him the warehouse had burned down. His mother hadn't made it out. The paramedic said she was sorry, but Leo felt hollow. He'd lost control, just like his mother had warned. Her death was his fault. Soon the police came to get him, and they weren't as nice. The fire had started in the break room, they said, right where Leo was standing. He'd survived by some miracle, but what kind of child locked the doors of his mother's workplace, knowing she was inside, and started a fire? Later, his neighbors at the apartment complex told the police what a strange boy he was. They talked about the burned handprints on the picnic table. They'd always known something was wrong with Esperanza Valdez's son. His relatives wouldn't take him in. His Aunt Rosa called him a diablo and shouted at the social workers to take him away. So Leo went to his first foster home. A few days later, he ran away. Some foster homes lasted longer than others. He would joke around, make a few friends, pretend that nothing bothered him, but he always ended up running sooner or later. It was the only thing that made the pain better. Feeling like he was moving, getting farther and farther away from the ashes of that machine shop. He promised himself he would never play with fire again. He hadn't thought about Tia Caída or the sleeping woman wrapped in earthen robes for a long time. He was almost to the woods when he imagined Tia Caída's voice.
"It wasn't your fault, little hero. Our enemy wakes. It's time to stop running."
"Hera," Leo muttered, "you're not even here, are you? You're in a cage somewhere."
There was no answer. But now at least, Leo understood something. Hera had been watching him his entire life. Somehow she'd known that one day she would need him. Maybe those fates she mentioned could tell the future. Leo wasn't sure. But he knew he was meant to go on this quest. Jason's prophecy warned them to beware the earth, and Leo knew it had something to do with that sleeping woman in the shop, wrapped in robes of shifting dirt.
"You will find your destiny," Tia Caída had promised. "Your hard journey will finally make sense."
Leo might find out what that flying boat in his dreams meant. He might meet his father, or even get to avenge his mother's death. But first things first. He'd promised Jason a flying ride. Not the boat from his dreams, not yet. There wasn't time to build something that complicated. He needed a quicker solution. He needed a dragon. He hesitated at the edge of the woods, peering into absolute blackness. Owls hooted, and something far away hissed like a chorus of snakes. Leo remembered what Will Solis had told him. No one should go in the woods alone, definitely not unarmed. Leo had nothing, no sword, no flashlight, no help. He glanced back at the lights of the cabins. He could turn around now and tell everyone he'd been joking. Psych! Nissa could go on the quest instead. He could stay at camp and learn to be part of the Hephaestus cabin. But he wondered how long it would be before he looked like his bunkmates. Sad, dejected, convinced of his own bad luck.
"They cannot stop me from breaking your spirit," the sleeping woman had said. "Remember this night, little hero. When they ask you to oppose me."
"Believe me, lady," Leo muttered. "I remember. And whoever you are, I'm gonna face plant you hard, Leo style."
He took a deep breath and plunged into the forest. Chapter 12. Leo. The woods weren't like any place he'd been before. Leo had been raised in a North Houston apartment complex. The wildest things he'd ever seen were that rattlesnake in the cow pasture and his Aunt Rosa in her nightgown until he was sent to wilderness school. Even there, the school had been in the desert. No trees with gnarled roots to trip over, no streams to fall into, no branches casting dark, creepy shadows, and owls looking down at him with their big, reflective eyes. This was the Twilight Zone. He stumbled along until he was sure no one back at the cabins could possibly see him. Then he summoned fire. Flames danced along his fingertips, casting enough light to see. He hadn't tried to keep a sustained burn going since he was 5, at that picnic table. Since his mom's death, he'd been too afraid to try anything. Even this tiny fire made him feel guilty. He kept walking, looking for dragon-type clues, giant footprints, trampled trees, swaths of burning forest. Something that big couldn't exactly sneak around, right? But he saw nada. Once he glimpsed a large, furry shape like a wolf or a bear, but it stayed away from his fire, which was fine by Leo. Then, at the bottom of a clearing, he saw the first trap. 100-foot-wide crater ringed with boulders. Leo had to admit it was pretty ingenious. In the center of the depression, a metal vat the size of a hot tub had been filled with bubbly dark liquid, Tabasco sauce and motor oil. On a pedestal suspended over the vat, an electric fan rotated in a circle, spreading the fumes across the forest. Could metal dragons smell? The vat seemed to be unguarded, but Leo looked closely, and in the dim light of the stars and his handheld fire, he could see the glint of metal beneath the dirt and leaves, a bronze net lining the entire crater. Or maybe see wasn't the right word. He could sense it there, as if the mechanism was emitting heat, revealing itself to him. 6 large strips of bronze stretched out from the vat like the spokes of a wheel. They would be pressure-sensitive, Leo guessed. As soon as the dragon stepped on one, the net would spring closed, and voila, 1 gift-wrapped monster. Leo edged closer. He put his foot on the nearest trigger strip. As he expected, nothing happened. They had to have set the net for something really heavy, otherwise they could catch an animal, human, smaller monster, whatever. He doubted there was anything else as heavy as a metal dragon in these woods. At least, he hoped there wasn't. He picked his way down the crater and approached the vat. The fumes were almost overpowering, and his eyes started watering. He remembered a time when Tia Kaida, Hira, whatever, had made him chop jalapenos in the kitchen, and he'd gotten the juice in his eyes. Serious pain. But of course she'd been like,
"Endure it, little hero. The Aztecs of your mother's homeland used to punish bad children by holding them over a fire filled with chili peppers. They raised many heroes that way."
A total psycho, that lady. Leo was so glad he was on a quest to rescue her. Tia Kaida would have loved this vat, because it was way worse than jalapeno juice. Leo looked for a trigger, something that would disable the net. He didn't see anything. He had a moment of panic. Nissa had said there were several traps like this in the woods, and they were planning more. What if the dragon had already stepped into another one? How could Leo possibly find them all? He continued to search, but he didn't see any release mechanism. No large button labeled off. It occurred to him that there might not be one. He started to despair, and then he heard the sound. It was more of a tremor, the deep sort of rumbling you hear in your gut rather than your ears. It gave him the jitters, but he didn't look around for the source. He just kept examining the trap, thinking,
"Must be a long way off. It's pounding its way through the woods. I gotta hurry."
Then he heard a grinding snort, like steam forced out of a metal barrel. His neck tingled. He turned slowly. At the edge of the pit, 50 feet away, 2 glowing red eyes were staring at him. The creature gleamed in the moonlight, and Leo couldn't believe something that huge had sneaked up on him so fast. Too late, he realized its gaze was fixed on the fire in his hand, and he extinguished the flames. He could still see the dragon just fine. It was about 60 feet long, snout to tail, its body made of interlocking bronze plates. Its claws were the size of butcher knives, and its mouth was lined with hundreds of dagger-sharp metal teeth. Steam came out of its nostrils. It snarled like a chainsaw cutting through a tree. It could have bitten Leo in half, easy, or stomped him flat. It was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen, except for one problem that completely ruined Leo's plan.
"You don't have wings," Leo said.
The dragon's snarl died. It tilted its head as if to say, "Why aren't you running away in terror?"
"Hey, no offense," Leo said. "You're amazing. Good God, who made you? Are you hydraulic or nuclear-powered, or what? But if it was me, I would have put wings on you. What kind of dragon doesn't have wings? I guess maybe you're too heavy to fly? I should have thought of that."
The dragon snorted, more confused now. It was supposed to trample Leo. This conversation thing wasn't part of the plan. It took a step forward, and Leo shouted,
"No!"
The dragon snarled again.
"It's a trap, Bronze Brain," Leo said. "They're trying to catch you."
The dragon opened its mouth and blew fire. A column of white-hot flames billowed over Leo, more than he'd ever tried to endure before. He felt as if he were being hosed down with a powerful, very hot fire hose. It stung a little, but he stood his ground. When the flames died, he was perfectly fine. Even his clothes were okay, which Leo didn't understand, but for which he was grateful. He liked his army jacket, and having his pants seared off would have been pretty embarrassing. The dragon stared at Leo. Its face didn't actually change, being made of metal and all, but Leo thought he could read its expression. Why no crispy critter? A spark flew out of its neck like it was about to short-circuit.
"You can't burn me," Leo said, trying to sound stern and calm.
He'd never had a dog before, but he talked to the dragon the way he thought you'd talk to a dog.
"Stay, boy. Don't come any closer. I don't want you to get caught. See, they think you're broken and have to be scrapped. But I don't believe that. I can fix you if you'll let me."
The dragon creaked, roared, and charged. The trap sprang. The floor of the crater erupted with a sound like 1,000 trash can lids banging together. Dirt and leaves flew, metal net flashing. Leo was knocked off his feet, turned upside down, and doused in Tabasco sauce and oil. He found himself sandwiched between the vat and the dragon as it thrashed, trying to free itself from the net that had wrapped around them both. The dragon blew flames in every direction, lighting up the sky and setting trees on fire. Oil and sauce burned all over them. It didn't hurt Leo, but it left a nasty taste in his mouth.
"Will you stop that?" he yelled.
The dragon kept squirming. Leo realized he would get crushed if he didn't move. It wasn't easy, but he managed to wriggle out from between the dragon and the vat. He squirmed his way through the net. Fortunately, the holes were plenty big enough for a skinny kid. He ran to the dragon's head. It tried to snap at him, but its teeth were tangled in the mesh. It blew fire again, but seemed to be running out of energy. This time the flames were only orange. They sputtered before they even reached Leo's face.
"Listen, man," Leo said, "you're just going to show them where you are. Then they'll come and break out the acid and the metal cutters. Is that what you want?
The dragon's jaw made a creaking sound, like it was trying to talk.
Okay, then, Leo said. You'll have to trust me.
And Leo set to work. It took him almost an hour to find the control panel. It was right behind the dragon's head, which made sense. He'd elected to keep the dragon in the net, because it was easier to work with the dragon constrained, but the dragon didn't like it.
Hold still, Leo scolded.
The dragon made another creaking sound that might have been a whimper. Leo examined the wires inside the dragon's head. He was distracted by a sound in the woods, but when he looked up, it was just a tree spirit. A dryad, Leo thought they were called, putting out the flames in her branches. Fortunately, the dragon hadn't started an all-out forest fire, but still the dryad wasn't too pleased. The girl's dress was smoking. She smothered the flames with a silky blanket, and when she saw Leo looking at her, she made a gesture that was probably very rude in dryad. Then she disappeared in a green poof of mist. Leo returned his attention to the wiring. It was ingenious, definitely, and it made sense to him. This was the motor control relay. This processed sensory input from the eyes. This disc...
Ha, he said. Well, no wonder.
Creak? The dragon asked with its jaw.
You've got a corroded control disc. Probably regulates your higher reasoning circuits, right? Rusty brain, man. No wonder you're a little... confused.
He almost said crazy, but he caught himself.
Wish I had a replacement disc, but this is a complicated piece of circuitry. I'm gonna have to take it out and clean it. Only be a minute.
He pulled out the disc, and the dragon went absolutely still. The glow died in its eyes. Leo slid off its back and began polishing the disc. He mopped up some oil and Tabasco sauce with his sleeve, which helped cut through the grime. But the more he cleaned, the more concerned he got. Some of the circuits were beyond repair. He could make it better, but not perfect. For that, he'd need a completely new disc, and he had no idea how to build one. He tried to work quickly. He wasn't sure how long the dragon's control disc could be off without damaging it. Maybe forever, but he didn't want to take chances. Once he'd done the best he could, he climbed back up to the dragon's head and started cleaning the wiring and gearboxes, getting himself filthy in the process.
Clean hands, dirty equipment, he muttered.
Something his mother used to say. By the time he was through, his hands were black with grease, and his clothes looked like he'd just lost a mud wrestling contest. But the mechanisms looked a lot better. He slipped in the disc, connected the last wire, and sparks flew. The dragon shuddered. Its eyes began to glow.
Better? Leo asked.
The dragon made a sound like a high-speed drill. It opened its mouth, and all its teeth rotated.
I guess that's a yes. Hold on, I'll free you.
Another 30 minutes to find the release clamps for the net and untangle the dragon, but finally it stood and shook the last bit of netting off its back. It roared triumphantly and shot fire at the sky.
Seriously, Leo said, could you not show off?
Creak, the dragon asked.
You need a name, Leo decided. I'm calling you Festus.
The dragon whirred its teeth and grinned. At least Leo hoped it was a grin.
Cool, Leo said. But we still have a problem, because you don't have wings.
Festus tilted his head and snorted steam. Then he lowered his back in an unmistakable gesture. He wanted Leo to climb on.
Where are we going? Leo asked.
But he was too excited to wait for an answer. He climbed onto the dragon's back and Festus bounded off into the woods. Leo lost track of time and all sense of direction. It seemed impossible the woods could be so deep and wild, but the dragon traveled until the trees were like skyscrapers and the canopy of leaves completely blotted out the stars. Even the fire in Leo's hand couldn't have lit the way, but the dragon's glowing red eyes acted like headlights. Finally, they crossed a stream and came to a dead end. A limestone cliff 100 feet tall, a solid sheer mass the dragon couldn't possibly climb. Festus stopped at the base and lifted one leg like a dog, pointing.
"What is it?"
Leo slid to the ground. He walked up to the cliff, nothing but solid rock. The dragon kept pointing.
"It's not gonna move out of your way," Leo told him.
The loose wire in the dragon's neck sparked, but otherwise he stayed still. Leo put his hand on the cliff. Suddenly his fingers smoldered. Lines of fire spread from his fingertips like ignited gunpowder, sizzling across the limestone. The burning lines raced across the cliff face until they had outlined a glowing red door 5 times as tall as Leo. He backed up and the door swung open, disturbingly silently, for such a big slab of rock.
"Perfectly balanced," he muttered. "That's some first-rate engineering."
The dragon unfroze and marched inside, as if he were coming home. Leo stepped through, and the door began to close. He had a moment of panic, remembering that night in the machine shop long ago, when he'd been locked in. What if he got stuck in here? But then lights flickered on, a combination of electric fluorescence and wall-mounted torches. When Leo saw the cavern, he forgot about leaving.
"Festus," he muttered, "what is this place?"
The dragon stomped to the center of the room, leaving tracks in the thick dust, and curled up on a large circular platform. The cave was the size of an airplane hangar, with endless work tables and storage cages, rows of garage-sized doors along either wall, and staircases that led up to a network of catwalks high above. Equipment was everywhere. Hydraulic lifts, welding torches, hazard suits, air spades, forklifts, plus something that looked suspiciously like a nuclear reaction chamber. Bulletin boards were covered with tattered, faded blueprints, and weapons, armor, shields, war supplies all over the place. A lot of them only partially finished. Hanging from chains far above the dragon's platform was an old tattered banner almost too faded to read. The letters were Greek, but Leo somehow knew what they said. Bunker 9.
Did that mean 9 as in the Hephaestus cabin, or 9 as in there were 8 others?
Leo looked at Festus, still curled up on the platform, and it occurred to him that the dragon looked so content because it was home. It had probably been built on that pad.
"Do the other kids know?"
Leo's question died as he asked it. Clearly this place had been abandoned for decades. Cobwebs and dust covered everything. The floor revealed no footprints except for his, and the huge paw prints of the dragon. He was the first one in this bunker since a long time ago. Bunker 9 had been abandoned with a lot of projects half-finished on the tables, locked up and forgotten. But why? Leo looked at a map on the wall, a battle map of camp, but the paper was as cracked and yellow as onion skin. A date at the bottom read 1864.
"No way," he muttered.
Then he spotted a blueprint on a nearby bulletin board, and his heart almost leapt out of his throat. He ran to the work table and stared up at a white line drawing almost faded beyond recognition. A Greek ship from several different angles. Faintly scrawled words underneath it read, "Prophecy? Unclear. Flight?" It was the ship he'd seen in his dreams, the flying ship. Someone had tried to build it here, or at least sketched out the idea. Then it was left, forgotten, a prophecy yet to come. And weirdest of all, the ship's masthead was exactly like the one Leo had drawn when he was 5. The head of a dragon.
"Looks like you, Festus," he murmured.
"That's creepy."
The masthead gave him an uneasy feeling, but Leo's mind spun with too many other questions to think about it for long. He touched the blueprint, hoping he could take it down to study, but the paper crackled at his touch, so he left it alone. He looked around for other clues. No boats. No pieces that looked like parts of this project. But there were so many doors and storerooms to explore. Festus snorted like he was trying to get Leo's attention, reminding him they didn't have all night. It was true. Leo figured it would be morning in a few hours, and he'd gotten completely sidetracked. He'd saved the dragon, but it wasn't going to help him on the quest. He needed something that would fly. Festus nudged something toward him. A leather tool belt that had been left next to his construction pad. Then the dragon switched on his glowing red eye beams and turned them toward the ceiling. Leo looked up to where the spotlights were pointing and yelped when he recognized the shapes hanging above them in the darkness.
"Festus," he said in a small voice, "we've got work to do."
Chapter 13. Jason. Jason dreamed of wolves. He stood in a clearing in the middle of a redwood forest. In front of him rose the ruins of a stone mansion. Low gray clouds blended with the ground fog, and cold rain hung in the air. A pack of large gray beasts milled around him, brushing against his legs, snarling and baring their teeth. They gently nudged him toward the ruins. Jason had no desire to become the world's largest dog biscuit, so he decided to do what they wanted. The ground squelched under his boots as he walked. Stone spires of chimneys, no longer attached to anything, rose up like totem poles. The house must have been enormous once, multi-storied with massive log walls and a soaring gabled roof, but now nothing remained but its stone skeleton. Jason passed under a crumbling doorway and found himself in a kind of courtyard. Before him was a drained reflecting pool, long and rectangular. Jason couldn't tell how deep it was, because the bottom was filled with mist. A dirt path led all the way around, and the house's uneven walls rose on either side. Wolves paced under the archways of rough red volcanic stone. At the far end of the pool sat a giant she-wolf, several feet taller than Jason. Her eyes glowed silver in the fog, and her coat was the same color as the rocks. Warm, chocolatey red.
"I know this place," Jason said.
The wolf regarded him. She didn't exactly speak, but Jason could understand her. The movements of her ears and whiskers, the flash of her eyes, the way she curled her lips, all of these were part of her language.
"Of course," the she-wolf said.
"You began your journey here as a pup. Now you must find your way back. A new quest, a new start."
"That isn't fair," Jason said, but as soon as he spoke, he knew there was no point complaining to the she-wolf.
Wolves didn't feel sympathy. They never expected fairness. The wolf said, "Conquer or die. This is always our way." Jason wanted to protest that he couldn't conquer if he didn't know who he was or where he was supposed to go. But he knew this wolf. Her name was simply Lupa, the mother wolf, the greatest of her kind. Long ago, she'd found him in this place, protected him, nurtured him, chosen him. But if Jason showed weakness, she would tear him to shreds. Rather than being her pup, he would become her dinner. In the wolf pack, weakness was not an option.
"Can you guide me?" Jason asked.
Lupa made a rumbling noise deep in her throat,
and the mist in the pool dissolved. At first, Jason wasn't sure what he was seeing. At opposite ends of the pool, two dark spires had erupted from the cement floor like the drill bits of some massive tunneling machines boring through the surface. Jason couldn't tell if the spires were made of rock or petrified vines, but they were formed of thick tendrils that came together in a point at the top. Each spire was about 5 feet tall, but they weren't identical. The one closest to Jason was darker and seemed like a solid mass, its tendrils fused together. As he watched, it pushed a little farther out of the earth and expanded a little wider. On Lupa's end of the pool, the second spire's tendrils were more open, like the bars of a cage. Inside, Jason could vaguely see a misty figure struggling, shifting within its confines.
"Hera," Jason said.
The she-wolf growled in agreement. The other wolves circled the pool, their fur standing up on their backs as they snarled at the spires. "The enemy has chosen this place to awaken her most powerful son, the Giant King," Lupa said. "Our sacred place, where demigods are claimed, the place of death or life. The burned house. The house of the wolf. It is an abomination. You must stop her."
"Her?" Jason was confused. "You mean Hera?"
The she-wolf gnashed her teeth impatiently. "Use your senses, pup. I care nothing for Juno, but if she falls, our enemy wakes, and that will be the end for all of us. You know this place. You can find it again. Cleanse our house. Stop this before it is too late."
The dark spire grew slowly larger, like the bulb of some horrible flower. Jason sensed that if it ever opened, it would release something he did not want to meet.
"Who am I?" Jason asked the she-wolf. "At least tell me that."
Wolves don't have much of a sense of humor, but Jason could tell the question amused Lupa. As if Jason were a cub just trying out his claws, practicing to be the alpha male.
"You are our saving grace, as always."
The she-wolf curled her lip as if she had just made a clever joke.
"Do not fail, son of Jupiter."
Chapter 14. Jason. Jason woke to the sound of thunder. Then he remembered where he was. It was always thundering in Cabin 1. Above his cot, the domed ceiling was decorated with a blue and white mosaic like a cloudy sky. The cloud tiles shifted across the ceiling, changing from white to black. Thunder rumbled through the room, and gold tiles flashed like veins of lightning. Except for the cot that the other campers had brought him, the cabin had no regular furniture, no chairs, tables, or dressers. As far as Jason could tell, it didn't even have a bathroom. The walls were carved with alcoves, each holding a bronze brazier or a golden eagle statue on a marble pedestal. In the center of the room, a 20-foot-tall, full-color statue of Zeus in classic Greek robes stood with a shield at his side and a lightning bolt raised, ready to smite somebody. Jason studied the statue, looking for anything he had in common with the Lord of the Sky. Black hair? Nope. Grumbly expression? Well, maybe. Beard? No thanks. In his robes and sandals, Zeus looked like a really buff, really angry hippie. Yeah, Cabin 1. A big honor, the other campers had told him. Sure, if you liked sleeping in a cold temple by yourself with hippie Zeus frowning down at you all night. Jason got up and rubbed his neck. His whole body was stiff from bad sleep and summoning lightning. That little trick last night hadn't been as easy as he had let on. It had almost made him pass out. Next to the cot, new clothes were laid out for him. Jeans, sneakers, and an orange Camp Half-Blood shirt. He definitely needed a change of clothes,
but looking down at his tattered purple shirt, he was reluctant to change. It felt wrong somehow, putting on the camp shirt. He still couldn't believe he belonged here, despite everything they'd told him. He thought about his dream, hoping more memories would come back to him about Lupa, or that ruined house in the Redwoods. He knew he'd been there before. The wolf was real. But his head ached when he tried to remember. The marks on his forearm seemed to burn. If he could find those ruins, he could find his past. Whatever was growing inside that rock spire, Jason had to stop it. He looked at Hippie Zeus. "You're welcome to help." The statue said nothing. "Thanks, Pops," Jason muttered. He changed clothes and checked his reflection in Zeus's shield. His face looked watery and strange in the metal, like he was dissolving in a pool of gold. Definitely he didn't look as good as Piper had last night after she'd suddenly been transformed. Jason still wasn't sure how he felt about that. He'd acted like an idiot, announcing in front of everyone that she was a knockout. Not like there'd been anything wrong with her before. Sure, she looked great after Aphrodite zapped her, but she also didn't look like herself, not comfortable with the attention. Jason had felt bad for her. Maybe that was crazy, considering she'd just been claimed by a goddess and turned into the most gorgeous girl at camp. Everybody had started fawning over her, telling her how amazing she was and how obviously she should be the one who went on the quest. But that attention had nothing to do with who she was. New dress, new makeup, glowing pink aura, and boom, suddenly people liked her. Jason felt like he understood that. Last night, when he'd called down lightning, the other campers' reactions had seemed familiar to him. He was pretty sure he'd been dealing with that for a long time. People looking at him in awe just because he was the son of Zeus, treating him special. But it didn't have anything to do with him. Nobody cared about him. Just his big, scary daddy standing behind him with the doomsday bolt, as if to say, "Respect this kid or eat voltage." After the campfire, when people started heading back to their cabins, Jason had gone up to Piper and formally asked her to come with him on the quest. She'd still been in a state of shock, but she nodded, rubbing her arms, which must have been cold in that sleeveless dress.
"Aphrodite took my snowboarding jacket," she muttered.
"Mugged by my own mom." In the first row of the amphitheater, Jason found a blanket and wrapped it around her shoulders.
"We'll get you a new jacket," he promised.
She managed a smile. He wanted to wrap his arms around her, but he restrained himself. He didn't want her to think he was as shallow as everyone else, trying to make a move on her because she'd turned all beautiful. He was glad Piper was going with him on the quest. Jason had tried to act brave at the campfire, but it was just that, an act. The idea of going up against an evil force powerful enough to kidnap Hera scared him witless, especially since he didn't even know his own past. He'd need help, and it felt right. Piper should be with him. But things were already complicated without figuring out how much he liked her, and why. He'd already messed with her head enough. He slipped on his new shoes, ready to get out of that cold, empty cabin. Then he spotted something he hadn't noticed the night before. A brazier had been moved out of one of the alcoves to create a sleeping niche, with a bedroll, a backpack, even some pictures taped to the wall. Jason walked over. Whoever had slept there, it had been a long time ago. The bedroll smelled musty. The backpack was covered with a thin film of dust. Some of the photos once taped to the wall had lost their stickiness and fallen to the floor. One picture showed Annabeth, much younger, maybe 8, but Jason could tell it was she, same blonde hair and gray eyes, same distracted look like she was thinking a million things at once. She stood next to a sandy-haired guy about 14 or 15, with a mischievous smile and ragged leather armor over a T-shirt. He was pointing to an alley behind them, like he was telling the photographer, "Let's go meet things in a dark alley and kill them." A second photo showed Annabeth and the same guy sitting at a campfire, laughing hysterically. Finally, Jason picked up one of the photos that had fallen. It was a strip of pictures like you'd take in a do-it-yourself photo booth. Annabeth and the sandy-haired guy, but with another girl between them. She was maybe 15, with black hair, choppy like Piper's, a black leather jacket, and silver jewelry, so she looked kind of goth. But she was caught mid-laugh, and it was clear she was with her two best friends. "That's Thalia," someone said. Jason turned. Annabeth was peering over his shoulder. Her expression was sad, like the picture brought back hard memories. "She's the other child of Zeus who lived here, but not for long. Sorry, I should have knocked."
"It's fine," Jason said. "Not like I think of this place as home."
Annabeth was dressed for travel, with a winter coat over her camp clothes, her knife at her belt, and a backpack across her shoulder. Jason said, "Don't suppose you've changed your mind about coming with us?" She shook her head.
"You got a good team already. I'm off to look for Percy."
Jason was a little disappointed. He would have appreciated having someone on the trip who knew what they were doing, so he wouldn't feel like he was leading Piper and Leo off a cliff.
"Hey, you'll do fine," Annabeth promised. "Something tells me this isn't your first quest."
Jason had a vague suspicion she was right, but that didn't make him feel any better. Everyone seemed to think he was so brave and confident, but they didn't see how lost he really felt. How could they trust him when he didn't even know who he was? He looked at the pictures of Annabeth smiling. He wondered how long it had been since she'd smiled. She must really like this Percy guy to search for him so hard, and that made Jason a little envious. Was anyone searching for him right now? What if somebody cared for him that much and was going out of her mind with worry, and he couldn't even remember his old life? "You know who I am," he guessed, "don't you?" Annabeth gripped the hilt of her dagger. She looked for a chair to sit on, but of course there weren't any.
"Honestly, Jason, I'm not sure. My best guess, you're a loner. It happens sometimes. For one reason or another, the camp never found you, but you survived anyway by constantly moving around. Trained yourself to fight, handled the monsters on your own. You beat the odds."
"The first thing Chiron said to me," Jason remembered, "was, 'You should be dead.'"
"That could be why," Annabeth said. "Most demigods would never make it on their own. And a child of Zeus, I mean, it doesn't get any more dangerous than that. The chances of your reaching age 15 without finding Camp Half-Blood or dying, microscopic. But like I said, it does happen. Thalia ran away when she was young. She survived on her own for years, even took care of me for a while. So maybe you were a loner too."
Jason held out his arm. "And these marks?"
Annabeth glanced at the tattoos. Clearly they bothered her.
"Well, the eagle is the symbol of Zeus, so that makes sense. The 12 lines, maybe they stand for years, if you've been making them since you were 3 years old. S-P-Q-R... That's the motto of the old Roman Empire. Senatus, populusque, Romanus. The Senate and the people of Rome. Though why you would burn that on your own arm, I don't know. Unless you had a really harsh Latin teacher."
Jason was pretty sure that wasn't the reason. It also didn't seem possible he'd been on his own his whole life. But what else made sense? Annabeth had been pretty clear. Camp Half-Blood was the only safe place in the world for demigods. I had a weird dream last night, he said. It seemed like a stupid thing to confide, but Annabeth didn't look surprised. Happens all the time to demigods, she said.